This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. You run a multi-billion dollar company. The president, to whom you are an unofficial advisor, does something, or in this case, doesn't do something. What do you do? Hint, not everybody's answer is going to be the same. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, the 14th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Seeing as how we have started this program more than once with a tweet from the chief executive, we will start today with a tweet from a chief executive. His name is Kenneth Frazier, the CEO of the pharmaceutical conglomerate Merck, who until this morning was a member of President Trump's Manufacturing Council. Merck's statement announcing his resignation from that council after the president's belated response to the events in Charlottesville this weekend, their tweet, if you will, read in part, "America's leaders must honor our fundamental views by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy, which run counter to the American ideal that all people are created equal. As CEO of Merck," he went on, "and as a matter of personal conscience, I feel a responsibility to take a stand against intolerance and extremism." Frazier and the dozens of other CEO advisors to the president are once again facing scrutiny over their response to a national issue with Trump himself at the center of the whole thing. Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going today.
Since Trump's remarks, statements from corporate America have been trickling in. Companies like Dow Chemical and General Electric say they condemn the violence, that they have no tolerance for hate or bigotry. Elliot Hoff heads up APCO Worldwide, a public relations consultancy.
Companies are being asked like never before to take positions on a wide variety of issues. Part of it is because of how divided the country is.
But after President Trump's lukewarm comments, most CEOs who advise him stayed on the sidelines and chose not to resign, says Hoff.
Those staying may feel like they could exert more influence staying close to the president than leaving.
Hoff says he advises companies to bring their executives together on a regular basis to see if they should take a stand on big national issues like immigration or, say, the environment. He says today values are closely tied to business, and his research shows that
consumers expect their companies, where they purchase from, to be advocates for them and for their beliefs.
But Jonathan Bernstein of Bernstein Crisis Management says the American attention span is super short, and statements from companies
might make an impact this week or next week at most. But like the news curve, people forget very quickly.
Unless, he says, activists make an especially loud scene. That's why many companies, Bernstein argues, stay neutral. They don't want to be the target of a boycott. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
President Trump did make a statement condemning the violence in Charlottesville today, a statement he began, we should say, by reciting his perception of his administration's economic achievements to date. There is, speaking of which, straight-up economic news coming at us this week. Trade negotiators from the U.S., Mexico, and Canada are going to meet in Washington to start trying to update NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And if you've read or heard how tricky the original negotiations were, well, imagine trying to layer more agreements on top of 20 years of economic infrastructure, or even more delicately, trying to undo perhaps what has already been done. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson talked to some former trade negotiators about how the renegotiating process might work.
The first part of any trade negotiation is figuring out what your country needs, what you want, what you can give, and what you can't, and then try and do that for the other side. Then all the agriculture guys from the various countries, they get in one room, the manufacturing guys in another. Eventually, the trade ministers, the big guns, they get together. Each negotiation round lasts maybe a week or so, and over many rounds, often stretching over years, you hopefully get a deal.
It's pretty intense. Trade negotiations are sort of all-consuming.
Darcy Vetter is the former chief agriculture negotiator for the United States Trade Representative under President Obama. She says, pro tip, pack snacks.
I'm a big fan of the granola bar and dried fruit.
Vetter says a typical negotiation can be split into easy, medium, and hard issues. The middle and the hard issues are what countries try and pair, trading something that's medium important to one country with something really important to their partner. But updating NAFTA, she thinks it's more like easy and hard issues.
And so figuring out how to create those trade-offs when you just have hard stuff and easy stuff, I think is a very interesting dynamic for our negotiators to try and to balance.
And it's going to be especially hard to give on something that's been the lay of the land for decades now. Mickey Cantor was the United States Trade Representative under President Clinton.
Giving up something that already has been relied upon one of your industries or having altered it in some way, I would think would be a difficult negotiation. I think, in fact, this would be very tough.
But then again, Cantor says the first go-around was tough, too. NAFTA was first finalized under President George Bush Sr. before Clinton took office. Clinton campaigned against the deal and would only agree to push it forward if he could tweak some things. Sound familiar? I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Yes, it does. On Wall Street today, snapback rally is the technical term you're looking for after last week. We will have the details when we do the numbers. James Patterson is a prolific fiction writer, extremely prolific fiction writer, you could say. His latest book, though, is at the very least inspired by true events or a true American company. Anyway, it's called The Store, capital T, capital S, an online shopping company that started with books and now does everything from food to clothing and points in between. Any guesses? Ms. Patterson, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Yeah.
Why this book now? I mean, you know, I'd figure a guy who does books for a living would not be interested in maligning a big, fat bookstore.
I'm not maligning a big, fat bookstore. I'm maligning the idea of monopolies in the country. And in particular, I think it's a problem when it threatens publishing. Because I think that books are really important in our lives, especially, you know, books that we can't live without. And I think right now, the people that are best equipped to put out serious books are publishers. That may evolve over time, but right now, publishers are pretty good at finding those books and paying to have them done and making sure that people are aware that they exist.
I'm going to guess you're not worried about James Patterson because you're doing fine, but you are a guy who could get Jeff Bezos on the phone. Right. And you could say, Jeff, look.
I don't know. I mean, I could.
Oh, come on. Of course you could.
He probably would read a letter if I said. I don't know. I mean, I met him once.
Yeah. How'd it go?
It was fine. I mean, what I said at that point was that, you know, the traffic at bookstores at that point was down about a third because a lot of people had gone over to e-books. And I said, the problem with that is that a lot of these people have kids. They're not going into bookstores anymore, and their kids have not made the switch to e-books. And I said, that's a problem. So there are a lot of households now where, you know, mom or dad used to go to the bookstore, bring the kids, and so that they were getting books to the kids. Mm-hmm. And I said that, you know, he was in a position to change that, even if it meant a lot more kids reading on e-books. And, you know, he said at the time, I'm on it. I don't know that I've seen evidence of that, but, yeah.
Well, so you and I have talked about this before, right? Your interest in getting kids and people outside traditional sort of mainstream, you know, novel readers in books, right? We talked about Bookshots. We've talked about a bunch of other stuff you've done. Do you take any heart from the fact that Amazon now has actual brick-and-mortar stores in some places?
Not particularly, no. I
tough guy to please.
I, it's kind of neutral. I know. I mean, that they are replacing, you know, independence and, well, you know, borders.
Yep.
I don't think it's necessarily a big step or a good step, but it might be. We'll see where it goes.
Can't let you go without asking you about this thing you got going with Bill Clinton. You're working on a book with him. You said before we turned the microphones on.
A novel.
Who called who? Did you call him or he called you?
We have the same agent. I had met him before. We had a really great meeting and just shooting the breeze. And I think we got along pretty well. And our mutual agent, who's a lawyer in Washington, brought up the idea. And it's really sounded exciting to both of us. And I mentioned the last time we were together, the president and I, it was in his place in Chappaqua. And we've had several of these 3-, 4-, 5-hour work sessions. Mm-hmm. And about 2 hours in, for whatever reason, it just washed over me. And I'm going, damn, I'm sitting here talking to Bill Clinton, you know? And it's amazing. It's amazing. Whether you're Republican or a Democrat. And one of the, I think, the interesting and important things for people to think about a little bit with respect to what's going on now in the world and how we demonize the left, demonize the right, depending on what side we're on. Clinton now, he's really good friends with the Bushes. Yeah. Both of them, both Bushes, and they will go and they will do good things together. And I think a lot of people in this country, if we could get over this demonizing the other side, you know, let's get in there and, you know, once the elections are done, let's go in there and do stuff. There's a lot of stuff that needs to get done, you know?
James Patterson, his most recent is called The Store. The Store is Always Watching. Did it with Rich
DeLong. Yeah. It's very different from what I've been doing, and I think people are going to get a kick out of it.
Thanks very much for your time, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you.
As this economy changes, life is changing too. Jobs are moving, levels of expertise are fading, and people are having to adjust. It's being felt especially hard in places where jobs, over time, sometimes over centuries really, have become ways of life. That's fishing in a whole lot of the small towns up and down the coast of Maine. But overfishing and climate change are forcing people to rethink the future of jobs and of education for the next generation. So today, in the latest story for our series, Way of Life, Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg takes us to a school that come this fall is going to put many of his students into the workplace to find careers closer to home.
On some days, students at the Harpswell Coastal Academy don't even see a classroom. This morning, sixth grader Easton Dundor shovels mulch into an outdoor hoop house that he helped design with a few other students. He says he likes it out here.
You get to work with other people. And you get to, like, see if you like that, you see if you don't, and it's just a really good opportunity, I think, before starting a job to do this kind of thing.
It may seem a little strange to hear a sixth grader talk about starting a job, but that's the goal of this school. It formed about 5 years ago when residents of the small coastal fishing village of Harpswell began to voice concerns about their kids' futures. Fishing has long been one of the economic drivers of many towns in coastal Maine. But overfishing, increased regulations, and climate change have largely wiped out many fisheries. In Harpswell, the number of residents with commercial fishing licenses fell by more than 25% since 2000. Harpswell Coastal Academy founder John Denary says that with an uncertain future, residents worried their kids would be less engaged and more likely to drop out.
A lot of our kids aren't able to envision a future for themselves, and they particularly aren't able to find a way to live in Maine if they can't lobster.
The solution was to create a new school focused on something called work-based learning, designed to expose kids to different kinds of jobs in Maine. Like farming, says school founder Joe Grady, who raises sheep and pigs.
We want to create things in these communities that kids are excited to be a part of. That's how they stay here as adults.
At school, kids still go to math and English classes in the morning and have to meet academic standards. But teacher Micah Depper says much of the rest of the day is spent on large group projects to teach skills he says employers want to see.
Perseverance, the ability to revise work. So at our school, our students help serve lunch. They take turns cleaning up the lunchroom, taking out the trash, yes, cleaning the bathrooms.
And once students get to high school, they've got to head out into the community and apply these skills in required internships.
Didn't she? Oh, I remember.
Like this student, pounding lemons and slices of naan bread here at a local restaurant called the New Beat Market. The Coastal Academy buys student lunches from the restaurant, and New Beat takes on 4 or 5 interns each year. It starts with simple dishwashing, but some students help with finances and create school lunch menus. Restaurant owner Jamie Pacheco.
And I do think it's really important that kids learn how to be a part of the workplace.
But she says a few kids have had to abandon their internships because they couldn't handle the stresses of the workplace.
It's interesting being part of that lesson. Kids' first jobs. It's an adventure.
Monique Coombs with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association says she thinks this is important for her industry, too. If kids pursue new career paths, maybe technology or public policy, Coombs says that could help everyone, including fishermen.
You know, value-added products, marine resources, and things that support the industry to make sure that there's a good future for young kids in the industry.
It'll likely take years or decades before the town will see if this strategy works. But Coombs hopes this shift is led by the young people who are already here. In Harpswell, Maine, I'm Robbie Feinberg for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think there is still something about network television. It's the way that it's accessible to people.
TV the way it used to be done. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 0.6% today. 135 points closed to 21,993. The NASDAQ added 1.4%. That is 87 points. Finished at 6,344. The S&P 500 up just over 1%. 25 points, 24 and 67 there. Financial stocks shook off last week's lousy results and bounced back. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 1.1%. Citigroup lifted 1.6%. July retail sales figures are coming out tomorrow, but some big department store chains took big markdowns today. JCPenney off 4%. Macy's unloaded about 1.3%. Kohl's, though, was an extra 0.1% to the good. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to spend some time in this part of the program on television, both the good old-fashioned network kind and the kind you can watch on whatever device you happen to have handy. Also, some of the corporate and creative intrigues at play as that transition happens. Netflix and Disney are where we're going to start, in the person of one Shonda Rhimes, content creator extraordinaire for Disney-owned ABC television the past decade or more. We learned last night that Rhimes, creator of Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, to name just two of many, is leaving Disney for Netflix. She will, of course, be well compensated, but Netflix has more than 50 original shows under its belt just this year. Content, while king, is expensive, so with $20 billion in outstanding debt and obligations, how long do you suppose Netflix can spend its way to success? Marketplace's Adam Ellington has that story.
Rhimes is one of the most successful TV producers of the past decade. Grey's Anatomy is running into its 14th season on ABC this fall.
Stop looking at me.
I'm not looking at you. I am not looking at you.
You are looking at me, and you watch me. And Finn has plans.
Michael Schneider is executive editor at IndieWire. He says this deal shows Netflix is relentlessly pursuing the best content.
This is a huge blow to broadcast TV, to ABC, to Disney, and a huge win for Netflix. This is a big deal.
But hit shows are few and far between, and making them isn't cheap.
They have created a lot of shows. And of the ones that really stand out that might make you subscribe to Netflix, I mean, how many of them can be House of Cards?
Stephen Follows is a producer who also researches data and statistics in the film industry. He says Netflix had over 90 Emmy nominations this year, but still hasn't earned the kind of loyalty as some legacy networks.
There's no sort of emotional bond with Netflix the way you might argue some people have with, say, Disney or even Marvel.
Follows points to Netflix $20 billion in debt, but Piper Jaffray analyst Mike Olson says the company's international ambitions are still in play.
Netflix is highly profitable domestically. They still have some work to do internationally, but we're at the inflection point of profitability outside the U.S. right now.
After spending 20% of its content budget on original programs last year, Olson says the company will up that to 50% next year. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Before there was Netflix or HBO or really cable television of any kind, there were networks and seasons of TV and shows that became, for want of a better word, water coolery, which is how I found myself on the Paramount Studios lot here in L.A. the other day talking to a guy who created and now runs one of the most popular network television shows going. This Is Us drew 15 million people a week last year on average. Season 2 starts September the 27th and Dan Fogelman is deep in production.
We're shooting tonight. We're actually shooting in the desert tonight with us. Sylvester Stallone is coming on and doing a whole war scene with us in a movie within the show tonight. So I'm heading out there today to work with Sly.
You call him Sly now?
Yeah, I guess. I'm trying it out.
Are you the decider? You're the guy?
Yes, apparently. I'm told. Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird position where you have to make these big decisions for this very popular show. And suddenly you still feel like a kid who's starting out doing a TV show and you realize, oh, crap, that I'm the one who's going to make the call that is the thing. And so
you wrote a thing in, and somebody's going to yell at me about this, either Variety or the Hollywood Reporter, I can't remember which, and it was an ode really to network television.
Yeah.
What is it about network TV for you as opposed to cable and Game of Thrones and HBO?
Well, I love cable. I was literally like a 10-year-old boy on the phone driving here talking to my best friend who was stuck in traffic, and we were analyzing the last episode of Game of Thrones nerds. So I love it all. For me, I grew up on network TV. I was born in 1976. And so the 80s were like, that was where I watched my television. I was kind of raised by television to a certain degree. So there was HBO a little if you were lucky enough to get it and you could see boobs. But for the most part, it was the four channels. Now, obviously, the world has shifted, but I think there is still something about network television. It's the way that it's accessible to people still. It's interesting. We're nominated for awards coming up with all these shows, the Better Call Sauls and the Handmaid's Tale and The Crown and all these really, really cable streaming shows.
Well, you know, to that point about the awards, I mean, this is, I think, the first network show nominated for an Emmy for Best Drama in like 6-ish years.
Yeah. If you had asked me a year ago, would we be in this kind of conversation and company? I didn't see that coming just because of the nature of the show. It's about people and there's a heavy dose of comedy and sentimentality. And those are death knell words for a show when you're trying to be critically well received.
What do you make of this whole peak TV argument that there's just so much, maybe too much?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there can ever be too much. I mean, supply and demand will dictate when too much is too much. When shows are no longer viable because there's just too many of them, they will make less shows. I think it's a real American art form right now, television, that's thriving. I think what I've been saying to people is, in this landscape, if you're going to come in with a show idea, you better be doing some part of it exceptionally, because otherwise, like, you're just going to get swallowed up by the amount.
What was the elevator pitch for this thing when you went to NBC?
I pitched them very comprehensively the second episode of the show, saying, I know you guys are very into this pilot that you just watched, and Mandy Moore and Milo Ventimiglia are adorable together. Yeah. And I love them. The second episode picks up 8 years later. Those little babies are now 8 years old. Milo has a mustache. He's drinking, and their marriage is at a crossroads. And like, the network had to get their head around that. Like, that's going to be the second episode of the show. And it seems really easy now to look back on it and say, oh yeah, that's a really cool idea. But that's a scary thing when you're pouring all the money they were pouring into in a show and putting it in their best time slot. And
so what's your stress level?
It was worse season one because it was all new and happening quickly. Now I'm just kind of zen, and I'm too tired to be stressed out. You don't get this opportunity much.
people are hanging on your every word on a television show, and it's in the zeitgeist, yeah. And there's going to be a Super Bowl this year, and after the Super Bowl, a gazillion people are going to tune into our television show, and I think it's going to be a big event. So
that's terrifying. That's terrifying.
No, because I've got really good people. The actors are so good. I can write some really bad stuff, and they'll make it seem really good, so I've already got that crutch. It's more like I want it to be perfect, and I want those big moments to be perfectly executed. So I'm driving people here crazy a little bit. Like, we shot a scene the other day that's awesome, and it's really good. But I didn't like a couple of aspects of it, and they're aspects that aren't just one-offs. They're going to come back in later episodes. And so I said, we're going back, and we're reshooting it because we have to get this right.
And that's you being the guy who makes the decisions. That's,
I guess.
I'm in charge.
Yeah, and spends the money, yeah. We've got this platform right now. We've got the show, and like, we got to take advantage of the moment. So it's more than stressful. It's exciting, I think.
Dan, thanks a lot.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, getting us back to where we started, the CEO advisory panel members and how they have reacted to the president's reaction to Charlottesville. We made calls today to 25 companies and organizations whose CEOs are on those panels. Here is part of what we got in return from Dell and CEO Michael Dell. Quote, thanks for reaching out. There is no change in Dell engaging with the Trump administration and governments around the world. From the AFL-CIO and President Richard Trumka, quote, we are aware of the decisions by other members of the President's Manufacturing Council. We are assessing our role. From General Electric and Chairman Jeff Immelt, quote, it's important for GE to participate in the discussion on how to drive growth and productivity in the U.S. Therefore, Jeff Immelt will remain on the Presidential Committee on American Manufacturing while he is the chairman of GE. And finally, Lockheed Martin and CEO Marilyn Hewson, quote, thanks for checking in. We don't have a comment. All right, we're out. The Dow up 0.6% today, 135 points. NASDAQ up 1.4%, 87 points. S&P 500 up just over 1%, 25 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.